Today we are going to start a... Hold that for me. Today we're going to start a new chapter of the Bhagavatam. This is the fourth canto, chapter 17. Maharaj Prithu becomes angry at the earth. Om Namo... translation purports by Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Maitreya Uvacha. Bhagavan Vainya Kapito Guna Karmadhi Chandayamasa Tan Kamai Pratipuja Abhinandhyacha. Maitreya Uvacha,
Evam
Sa Bhagavan Vainya, Kyapito Guna Karmavi, Kyapito Guna Karmavi, Chandayama Satan Kamai, the great sage Maitreya continued in this way. The reciters who were glorifying Maharaj Prithu readily described his qualities and chivalrous activities. At the end, Maharaj Prithu offered them various presentations with all due respect and worshipped them adequately. There's no purport for this verse. In fact, there's no purport for the next three verses. So, let's take a look here. Maitreya Uvacha, Maitreya said. Maitreya, of course, means the son of Mitra. Evam, thus. So when a chapter begins, or any sentence begins with the word evam, thus, it's referring to what just happened. Same as in English. When you say thus, you're concluding something that you said earlier. So evam here, thus, refers to previous chapter where the sages glorified Prithu Maharaj. Who's called Vainya here because he was the son of Vaina. So, he's called Vainya, son of Vaina. It's interesting because Vaina, of course, was a complete villain. He was demonic, and yet still, that was his father. So he's called Vainya, which is sort of an interesting little cultural touch there. You think that, you know, you could imagine a culture in which you don't want to talk about that, who his father was, but here he's called Vainya. So evam thus, sa bhagavan, he the Lord, Vainya, kyapito. Kyapito is described, Prabhupada here puts glorified. Kya means to narrate, like akhyana means a narration. And this is the causative, past passive participle, which means literally that he was caused to be described. In other words, he was glorified, he was described. He was described guna karma bi according to his qualities, guna. The word guna in Sanskrit can mean the material qualities, goodness, passion, and ignorance, but in a more general sense, it can simply mean a quality. And as in English, you could say someone has good qualities or bad qualities, but if you just say this person has qualities, it tends to mean good. It tends to mean good qualities. If you just use the word guna by itself, it tends to mean, and the same in Sanskrit. So, for example, it's very common antonyms, opposite words in Sanskrit, are guna and dosha, which means a good quality and a bad quality, or a virtue and a fault. Guna, dosha, you find that throughout our literature. So, here, it simply says he was described in terms of his qualities, and that means his good qualities. It doesn't mean in terms of the modes of nature, which is a special use of the word guna. And karma, his actions. Again, the word karma, from the Sanskrit root kar, or as devotees pronounce it, kri, and we still have words in English from that Sanskrit root, words like create or increase are actually from the Sanskrit verb to do or to make, create. So here, karma literally means action. And in other words, something you do intentionally. That's an action. So here, Krishna, Lord Prithu, is glorified in terms of his qualities and his actions. Again, just like guna can have a special meaning in terms of the modes of nature, karma takes on a special meaning in terms of the reactions to your previous activities, but in a larger sense, it simply means action or activity. And Krishna uses the word himself that way. For example, the Bhagavad Gita, what has Krishna said? God, I can't believe I forgot that verse. Hope this is not age-related. Krishna says, one who understands my actions, birth, janma karma cha me divyam. Janma karma cha me divyam. So what Krishna says, that one who even joveti tatvata, one who understands literally categorically, tatvata, in truth. In other words, not thinking that Krishna's body is material, not thinking that Krishna's material, not thinking that Krishna is a jiva. These are three basic tattvas, the three fundamental categories of reality, which are the soul, jiva. Therefore, we say jiva tattva. We say jiva tattva because tattva here means a fundamental category, a real thing. I've explained this many times before, may I do one more time? At no extra cost to you. The Sanskrit word tat, if you just add an H after the T, it's English, that. It's the same word. English just added an H, so you could bite your tongue when you say it, that, for some strange reason. But anyway, tat means that, and that is a demonstrative pronoun. It means it's a word that points out something, like which house, that house, which person, that person. And so the word that is used to demonstrate, to point out something. Therefore, it's a demonstrative pronoun. And in philosophical Sanskrit, where they put great value on brevity of speech, the more you can say in the fewest possible words, the bigger a prize you get. And we find this even, for example, in modern physics, looking for a simple equation that explains all equations. And so, tat, because it points out something, comes to mean in philosophical Sanskrit a real thing. And since all real things ultimately owe their existence to one supreme real thing, therefore tat comes to mean the absolute truth. That's kind of the logic, as in, for example, Om Tat Sat. So that's the word tat. And if you add the little suffix, twa is something like the English suffix ty, which is probably related to the Sanskrit. So for example, if someone is generous, they have generosity. And so generosity is the quality of being generous. Or what's another one?
Humanity.
Huh?
Humanity.
No, that ends in ty. Humanity. What?
Humanity,
yes. The being human in the sense of empathetic to other humans is humanity. The quality of being sort of an empathetic human. And so religiosity, the quality of being religious, is religiosity. So we have T-Y, Sanskrit, twa, and anyway, won't go into all the grammar here, but therefore, tatwa means the quality or the state of being a real thing. Tatwa, the state or the quality of being a real demonstrable object in the world. That's tatwa. Tatwa is usually translated as truth, but it means truth in a special sense. It means categorical truth because, for example, jiva tatwa, that means the jiva as a category, not just one or another jiva, not you or me, but the category of jiva as a fundamental category of real things. Or Vishnu tattva, same thing, that Vishnu stands here for a category of fundamental real things, namely plenary manifestations of God, or Prakriti tattva. So that's what, and therefore when Krishna, in that famous verse in Bhagavad Gita, where he says, it's translated, learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, literally Krishna says, tad vidhi, again, tad, know that. Vidhi is just the imperative of the verb to know, vid, veda. And so vidhi means know, it's the command, know. So Krishna says, tad vidhi, know that, meaning know that truth. Tad vidhi and so on. And then he says that tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena seve upadekshanti. Upadekshanti is just the, I know you all love grammar, upadekshanti is the plural future tense of the verb to instruct. That's an upadeshamrita. Upadesha means instruction, right? It's an actor of instruction. So they will instruct. Upadekshanti simply means they will instruct. And so here it's actually plural, that know this truth because they, gyaninas, those who have knowledge, will give you knowledge. It's sort of a, you could say it's tautological, but it's an interesting point. Krishna puts these two words, gyanino and gyanam, together. So he says, upadekshanti te gyanam gyaninas. He's making a point just simply by the syntax. In other words, the word order. Because in Sanskrit, you have much more freedom than in English to change the word order because you know what's the subject and what's the object of the sentence, not by the word order, but rather by the endings. Anyway, it's an inflected language. So the fact that there is this freedom of word order in Sanskrit, much more than English, the fact that Krishna puts these two words together, upadekshanti te gyanam gyaninas, gyanam gyaninas, he's making a point. He's saying that people who have knowledge can give you knowledge. Someone can't give you knowledge if they don't have it. And that's, it's a simple but powerful point. Upadekshanti, they will teach jnana, knowledge, jnaninas, those who have knowledge. And he said, he calls these people who will teach you knowledge are tattva darshina, seers of the truth, it's translated. But again, technically, Krishna says seers of tattva. Seers of tattva. And so what does it mean to be a seer of tattva? It means to be a seer, and by seeing, that's how Krishna usually says, like, you've realized it. Not just something you learned in a book and you can pass a test, but you really understood it deeply. You've seen it. You've seen the truth. And so, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna often uses the word, different words for seeing as a synonym for knowing. When you really see something, then you really know it. That's throughout the Gita. So, what does it mean to be a seer of tattva? For one thing, it means that you see the fundamental categories of reality. You see, for example, if you think Krishna has a material body, then that is a tattva mistake. It's a category mistake. You're confusing Ishvara or Vishnu tattva with Prakriti tattva. Or if you think Krishna is an ordinary living being, another category mistake. In other words, a tattva mistake, you're confusing jiva and Vishnu. Or if you think I am my body, It's another category mistake. You're confusing jiva and prakriti. So to be tattva darshi, to see tattva, as Krishna says in the Gita, means you are very clear on the fundamental categories of reality. And that's the sense also in the famous Bhagavatam verse, Vedanti Tattva Vidas, and so on. So, now, there's a word which means someone that cannot make accurate distinctions, who cannot identify the different tattvas. There's a word for it, which is nirvishesha. Perhaps if you, Hare Krishna, if you sat maybe a little bit on that side, then you could still hear the class. And yeah, I mean, we want you to hear the class, but if you just sat a little bit over there outside, then you can hear me, but I can't hear the Vaikuntha child. So, yeah, right there. It doesn't have to go so far. If she just stops right there, she can still hear the class. So, Vishesha in Sanskrit means a distinction. So, for example, the word Visheshana means an adjective. Because an adjective is a word that distinguishes nouns. Like, for example, person, which person? I guess that's infantile primal scream therapy. Anyway, so for example, if you say which person, if you say the old person, the young person, the this person, that person, so adjectives distinguish the red house, the blue house, and so the word for adjective in Sanskrit is visheshana in Sanskrit grammar. So vishesha means the same thing, of course. So nirvishesha means someone who cannot distinguish. And what can they not distinguish? They can't distinguish the tattvas. They can't distinguish the tattvas. They are confused about jiva, Vishnu, and prakriti, or God, the soul, and nature. So that's actually what it means when said that Prabhupada is saving the Western countries from those who cannot understand what the tattvas and Shunyavada and Voida. So getting back to this verse, Krishna himself says that his karma is divine. Janma, my birth, janma karma cha, me, my divyam, my divine birth and action. So again, the word karma in the most simple, general sense, simply means action, and then in a special sense, it means the reactions to your previous activities. That's why here in this verse it said, Kyapito guna karma vi, that Prithu is glorified by his qualities and actions, not meaning by his modes of nature and his karma, but by simply by his qualities and actions. And then Chandiyamasa tan kamai, which in Sanskrit means that he satisfied them. He satisfied them. Chandi Amasa. I won't go into all the grammar here. So, but anyway, he satisfied them. Kamai, with wishes. Here's another word. We have a third word here, which has a special meaning and a general meaning. Kama has a special meaning of lust or sex desire or selfish desire. But the word kama has a more general meaning. It simply means desire or wish. For example, if you have the word desire, and then if you make the past participle desired, that word is kanta. Kanta is just the past participle of kama. And so it's used to describe Krishna. Krishna is gopi kanta. He's the one who's desired by the gopis. Or there's so many words, names for Krishna ending in kanta. Raja Kanta, yes, and so on. So in that sense, Kanta, again, just the past participle of Kama, simply means desired. He's the desired of Radha, the desired of the gopis, and so on. And so here, the word kama, kamai, which is, just means by the desires, it means in a general sense, not in the special sense of sex desire or selfish desire in general. And so therefore, it means that Prithu satisfied them, or literally fulfilled their desires by granting their wishes. Kamai, by granting their wishes. And Pratipuja. Puj means to honor. In Sanskrit, it's a verb. Sometimes there's a sort of an urban legend in Sanskrit that Puj means something else in some or another modern Indian language, but actually in Sanskrit it doesn't. That's the verb Puj. And it means to worship, but it also means to honor. In fact, Prabhupada here translates it offering all respects. So in the Western world, the same English, the word worship is a word which is often reserved, or people think it's appropriate to reserve it for God. You don't worship human beings. You don't worship even other souls. You worship God. And so sometimes they may object to the fact, for example, we have Guru Puja. What I explain to people is that the word puja does not simply mean worship. It means honor. So if you wanted to say in Sanskrit, honor your father and mother, which is one of the Ten Commandments, this is the word you would use. There are other words, but you could very much use this word. For example, when people, at least traditional Indians, Hindus, when they write letters to their, say to their father, they write puja, pita, isn't it? That's like a common thing, puja pita. It doesn't mean, it can mean worshipful, but it simply means like honorable father. Puja literally means or honorable father. And so here, prati in Sanskrit, you see it up there? Follow the balancing chakra. Prati means counter or reverse. So prati puja means honoring return. They honored him, and he returned the honors. In other words, he sent the honors back in the opposite direction. And that's what prati means, prati puja. He honored them in return. For example, the fifth stage of Ashtanga Yoga is pratyahara. Because ahara means sense activities, like engaging the senses with their objects, and then prati means you pull the senses back in the opposite direction, you pull them within. So that's the word. It also means other things. It can mean also each, like each step, like what does Lord Chaitanya said? Pratipadam purnamritas. So pratipadam means at every step. So these are, I mean, they're the word, this, it's a prefix, prati. It has various meanings. One common meaning is counter and reverse, going the opposite way, as in pratyahara or pratipuja. It can also mean each, like pratipadam, at each step. Anyway, that's what it says. So, chandya vasa tan kamai pratipuja abhinandya cha. Abhinandya here is translated offering prayers. Nand is an important Sanskrit verb. That's the root nand. The Sanskrit language was always conceived of by ancient grammarians as beginning from roots. That the idea is that every Sanskrit word sort of grows out of a root, sort of an organic botanical image of language. That there are roots, and there are stems, and then there are, and so on. So we talk about verbal roots, which are roots in the sense of all the words grow out of those roots. So the root nand, the word nand means to take pleasure, give pleasure, and if you add the prefix ah, which intensifies the sense, you have ananda. That's where you get the word ananda, which means intense pleasure or bliss. And also this root nand, pleasure, is taken to be an abbreviation of nand, would be na, as in Krishna. And so when it's said that Krishna means all attractive, because Krish means to attract in Sanskrit. Interesting. If you think, you don't mind a little etymology, do you? I mean, after all, you are in the Hare Krishna movement. I thought you might be interested to know where all this stuff comes from. So why does Krish in Krishna mean attractive or all attractive, and Krishi from the same root means plowing? Well, there's a very obvious answer, right? Because think of the relationship between the two English words, traction and attraction. Traction means plowing, like a tractor. It means pulling something. So that's what traction is, pulling something has traction. So pulling. So because the ox pulls the plow, or the tractor pulls the plow, that's traction. And if something pulls the mind, that's attraction. So that's why Trish means attractive, because attractive, or just tractive, means something that has traction. So that's why the same word means attractive, or all attractive, and plowing.
Like a magnet.
What?
Like a magnet.
Not exactly, yeah, like a magnet would be a case, but yes, be like a magnet. Traction, attraction. So Krish means attracting, and Na is taken as an abbreviation of Nand, this verb Nand, which means to give pleasure or take pleasure. So Krishna is the source of pleasure, and Krishna is the all attractive one. Anyway, so Abhi Nandya, Abhi means toward, it can mean against something or toward it. And Abhinandya means directing pleasure to them. In other words, Prabhupada translates, you're offering prayers. The idea is that pleasing them. In this case, Prabhupada takes it to mean by prayers, but that's what Nand literally means, that he directed happiness toward them in a sense, which can mean celebrating someone, rejoicing, and so on and so forth. So that's Abhinandya. So there's a sense here of not merely offering prayers, but actually giving them pleasure, pleasing them, satisfying them, which can be by appropriate prayers. So, that's the verse. That was a word for word, by the way. Maitreya uvacha evam sa bhagavan vainya khyapito guna karma bhi chandiyam asa tam kamai pratipuja vinandya cha. So here, I'll just say a few words. Most of the class, of course, will be the word for word, but say a few words that here we see Vedic culture in action, because we see a relationship between a political leader and spiritual or religious leaders. And we see the relationship is working very well. There is great mutual benefit, not only for the individuals concerned, but for the world in general. Now, it didn't always go this smoothly. We may think that long ago, Brahmins and Kshatriyas always loved each other and cooperated, and sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. And it's the Mahabharata itself, and even the Bhagavatam, that gives us examples when the relationship breaks down. So, one unforgettable example is when the Kshatriyas killed Parashuram's father, and then Parashuram, as a Brahmin, killed all the Kshatriyas. So that's not the Varna system working optimally when Brahmins and Kshatriyas are killing each other. And this is not the only case. In Mahabharata, we have examples. For example, there was a sage called Orva, from the Sanskrit word uru, which means thigh, because there was a time when, according to the Mahabharata, this is the story anyway, that the Brahmins were hoarding wealth. And they were hoarding wealth at a time when the country, this particular country, had perhaps a drought. Usually poverty in pre-industrial societies is caused by drought. Of course, it can also be caused by military catastrophe and so on. But in any case, there was poverty, people were suffering, and the Kshatriyas discovered that the Brahmins were hoarding wealth. And therefore, the Kshatriyas went and massacred them. And so again, this is the Varna system, little glitch here. And so one Brahmana lady hid her little child, her son, in her thigh, and therefore he became Orva, from the word Uru, thigh. Of course, the Bhagavatam gives an explanation to exonerate the Brahmins, and they said that the Brahmins had performed so many pious activities, that they had such incredible longevity, they're going to live so long, but they were anxious to go to higher planets, and suicide is sinful, so they arranged for the Kshatriyas to kill them, which is an interesting interpretation. And it certainly makes the Brahmins look good. Anyway, so I give this as an example of sometimes the system not working so well. And there are cases where, like in the case of Sudasa, the king, where his guru cursed him, he counter-cursed his guru, they both got reactions. Again, system's breaking down. And of course, we have many, many, many examples where the system works very well. So why should the system break down? Because the Brahmins and Kshatriyas are the two highest social orders, and power corrupts. Power corrupts. So and you can see there's sort of, even if you just look at the language of Shastra, there's kind of a built-in tension, because you say one class is the rishis, the Brahmins, the other class is the kings, the Rajas, but then there's the Rajarshi. And so, in fact, if you look at about 2,500 years ago, the spread of Buddhism and Jainism, Jainism, by the way, at one point was just as powerful as Buddhism in the world. Buddhism continued to grow and Jainism shrunk. But if you go back a couple thousand years, they were both very powerful in India. And they were both, these movements were both inaugurated and spread by Kshatriyas, who were just sick and tired of Brahmins lording it over them. And so you have a time 2,500 years ago where the Brahmins have become oppressive, misusing their religious and spiritual power, well, more religious in this case. And therefore you have a Kshatriya revolt, which actually takes the form of two new religions. So, and then of course you have kings, because kings were educated, kings were taught the Vedas, and therefore you can have a Rajarshi who says, like, well, I'm a Rishi, we don't need, why should I share power with Brahmins? Because I'm also a sage. And you can have Brahmins who develop all these mystic powers by their meditation, by their yoga, and they say, well, who needs Kshatriyas? You know, we can do it ourselves. And so, again, a lot of the time, the system was working well, as we see here. So what we see here, Brahmins and Kshatriyas cooperating, this was not a rare event. This was often the case. But also, there are many examples in Shastra where the system breaks down and the two most powerful classes turn against each other. And obviously, those examples are given as a warning. As a warning of bad things that actually happen in this world. So therefore, I'm pointing out, here we have an exemplary case of Brahmana Kshatriya cooperation and mutual appreciation, but it's not something that always happened. And so there, and which makes this particular case impressive. In fact, we need look no farther than Prithu's own father to see a Kshatriya who enslaved the Brahmanas, or wanted to enslave them. And that wasn't the only case of kings trying to turn sages into their servants. There are other cases. There was a famous king, I think his name is Nahusha, who had Brahmin sages carry his palanquin. And of course, he got a very nasty reaction. They got rid of him, and they put him, his next life was one you wouldn't want for yourself. So, but again, there are these many cases of the Brahmin Kshatriya orders turning against each other, and so therefore, when we hear about Prithu and the sages, you shouldn't think, well, of course, that's just normal Vedic culture. Well, it is, but it's also something which deserves our appreciation, because it's not automatic, and it didn't happen all the time. So that's important point. Anyway, any questions on all this? Yes?
Sure, as far as linguistics are concerned, I understand the language of the role. Did Sanskrit, or does Sanskrit also evolve, or is it an internal language?
Well, first of all, the Sanskrit literature, Shastra, practically never speaks about itself as a language. For example, there's no verse anywhere in Shastra that says that Sanskrita Adi Bhasha or something. Sanskrit is the original language. What the word Sanskrit literally means, it's actually the same word as samskara. It's just a different word. Samskara is a noun, and Sanskrita is just a participle. What is this? A past participle. It's the same word. And Prabhupada always translated samskara as reformatory. Reforming, perhaps, another word which is perhaps more clear is refining. Refining. So reform, refining, literally reforming, like refining, bringing something to a better form. And so Sanskrita is a refined language. It's a language. Thank you. It's a language which it has been refined, which has been developed, a sophisticated language. And so you could take this to mean that it's refining of what? Like, was there a previous language which was crude, and now it's been refined? So, my late godbrother, Gopi Pranadana, who worked with me on the Bhagavatam translation, he once mentioned, that was a very intelligent point, that if you look at Krishna, when Krishna comes to this world, in fact, all of Krishna's avatars in various forms, Krishna inserts himself into an already existing genealogy, family line. So, of course, Krishna is the original person. He exists before the universe, and he creates the universe. But when he appears in this world, he inserts himself within a family. So he has father, parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and going back thousands of generations. And yet he's Adi Purusha. He's the original person. And so, in that sense, Gopi Pranadana said that, well, perhaps Sanskrit, like that, is an original language. However, it appears within a language family, just as Krishna appears within a family. I thought that was really smart. So, in any case, ultimately, we do know also that Sanskrit changes over time. So, if you look at what is called Vedic Sanskrit, by the way, the Shastra, the Bhagavatam, uses the word Veda the way the modern scholars do. We often use the word Vedic to mean the whole culture, but actually the Bhagavatam uses it the way modern scholars do to mean Shruti literature. Shruti literature. And so if you look at, and then in the sense of Shruti and Smriti, so you can use it both ways, but when we say Vedic grammar, and there actually you can get a book of Vedic grammar because it's an older form of Sanskrit. And then what's called classical Sanskrit, which is Mahabharata, Bhagavatam, and so on. Although the Bhagavatam, by the way, which is considered one of the most linguistically sophisticated Sanskrit literatures, it's known for that. And so it has some older forms. But just to give an example of a few differences between Vedic Sanskrit and classical Sanskrit, there are words in Vedic Sanskrit and no one really knows what they mean. Mm-hmm. Because they're not used anymore. They're archaic. So the vocabulary of the, let's say, the Rig Veda contains words that were no longer used in classical Sanskrit, and so therefore we can only speculate about what they meant. Another example, common example, is that in Sanskrit, I hope you don't mind me explaining all this. After all, you did voluntarily join the Hare Krishna movement. So, another example is Sanskrit, and this is something which we still have in English, by the way, changes the meanings of words by adding prefixes. So, for example, the Sanskrit verbal root vart means to turn. And so you can say, for example, and then from vart, from that root, you get the word vritti. So you can say pravritti, which means to turn or to funk, to go forward, like you, things you actually do. Pravritti marg means you engage your senses, like if you have sex desire, you get married. That's a typical example. And then nivritti means that you turn away. Like you, so pravritti means literally you turn towards something, you engage it. Nivritti means you turn away from it. So in the nivritti mark, if you have sex desire, you somehow control it and renounce. And so which one is appropriate just depends on your nature. But they're both spiritual paths. So you can say pravritti or pravartate, the verb, or nivartate. Or you can say anuvartate, which means to turn along or to follow someone. So anubritti means to follow. Anubritti also means translation because it follows the literal sense of the original. So anyway, you have all these prefixes. Anubritti, pravritti, or pravritti, anubritti, and so abhivritti, like the abhivartika cloud. So you can put all these different sangbritti, vibritti, sung together, v apart. So all these different prefixes have different meanings. Now English not only still retains that, by the way, but it even has that verb. I chose that verb, vert, because we still have it in English as vert, as invert, revert, pervert, subvert, introvert, extrovert. It's the same Sanskrit verb, vert, practically pronounced the same. And English, so in retaining the English, in retaining the Sanskrit stem, vert, which is English, vert. That's an example of the same word coming, but there's also something in grammar which is structural, or they call it morphology, where English may not retain like anu or abhi, but retains the same structure. So we have this English stem vert, and then we add prefixes to it to change the meaning. Invert, revert, subvert, pervert, extrovert, and so on. So the English, the connection between English and Sanskrit is not only that some words sound the same, like in Sanskrit, if you want to say brother, you say brother. Actually, in Sanskrit, you wouldn't say, well, Mataji. That's actually Hindi. If you wanted to say it in Sanskrit, you would say Mater. So not only the words sound the same because they're coming from the same source, but even the structure. So I forgot, what was I talking about? I got into all that, but...
Early Sanskrit.
Yeah. So, okay, here's the point. Thank you. So, in Vedic Sanskrit, earlier Sanskrit, such as the Rig Veda and other literatures, prefixes and the word they modify can be separated. Like in English, you can say that, let's say, into the great house I went. So into is like a preposition, and you can separate it from went. In later classical Sanskrit, you kind of put them together. You don't separate them. So let's say you were saying anu gachati, which means to follow. Gachati means he goes, he or she goes, and anu means along, like to follow. So in classical Sanskrit, you'd always say anu gachati, whereas in earlier Sanskrit, you could say anu sa da 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 gachati. So you can separate the prefixes and the verbs of the nouns, and that's done all the time. There are verb cases, Sanskrit, Vedic, you can see how things are. Classical Sanskrit, which is considered perhaps the most difficult language to learn, is actually a simplification of Vedic Sanskrit. Because in Vedic Sanskrit, you have other verb tenses which are not used anymore in classical Sanskrit. Like there's a subjunctive. To give an example, their English subjunctive isn't used very much anymore. It's used a lot in Latin languages like Spanish and Portuguese. But for example, you would say in English, he goes. right? He goes. But the subjunctive would be, I want that he go. It's important that he go. Of course, people that don't do fancy English might say, it's important that he goes. That's an example how the English subjunctive is kind of vanishing, but originally in the more complex form of English, it's important that he go. It's important that he see how important this is. And so Sanskrit has a subjunctive case, which drops out in classical Sanskrit. It also has other cases, such as, which scholars are still trying to figure out exactly what they mean. So there's all these sophisticated verb tenses which drop out. So in many ways, either in terms of verb tenses, in terms of the structure, the formation of words with prepositions, in terms of vocabulary, there are differences. Just like, for example, you can look at, if you read Shakespearean English, or let's say the English of the 19th century, Jane Austen or Charles Dickens, or modern English. And now the newer generations are very happily reducing English to sort of like a vocabulary of 33 words. You know, of course, you don't really need to do two. One starts with an S, the other starts with an F. And those two words you can use to express most things you want to say in English. Tweeting also, and texting is helping to develop our language. Yes.
Like in German, this going ich gehe.
Yes.
Ich gehe ein Kaffee, Kaffee.
Yeah. Ich gehe. Gehen in German is English go. That's Sanskrit go. It's the same word. Yes. So yes. Well, that was a big dose of grammar. You're probably going to need a big breakfast now. Or yes.
What's the root of the Jainism? Or where is that?
Of the what?
Jain.
Jain. A person named Jinnah.
Yeah. And what's the teaching?
The teaching is basically there's an eternal soul, but there's no God. And you renounce the world and... It has. I mean, it's nice because they're the super non-violent people. They wear masks. They won't breathe bugs in and all that. And so, they're nice. They're nice people. And, soul but no God. They have this weird thing where, I don't want to criticize them because they're nice people, but they have this philosophy that when you eat food, you get karma because inevitably it involves either disturbing or killing some life form, even vegetarian food. So what the sages do is they never cook. They let the grihasthas literally eat, cook, get all the karma, and they eat the food karma free. So that's the sign of a true saint. He dumps his miserable karma on the householders, right? Admirable. It's funny because in South India they were called Ambara in Sanskrit, can mean dress or clothes. That's why Balaram, Nila means blue, so Balaram's called Nilambara, which means he wears blue clothes. Mm-hmm. And Digambara, dig means the directions, or like just the air. And so they would go naked, the Jain sages in the South India, I guess, because it's so hot down there, everyone goes half naked anyway. I mean, at least back in ancient times. So, So in South India, they were called Digambara, like dressed by the directions, which is a sort of a polite way. It's a polite way of saying naked in Sanskrit. Whereas in North India, you couldn't do that. Like, hey, dude, you're naked. So in North India, they became Shwetambara. Shweta means white, like Shweta Dweep, the white island. So they would wear white clothes. And so they actually, it's funny, you can see, believe it or not, if you're in the Hare Krishna movement, you'll find this very hard to understand. But people claiming to be very spiritual can take outer dress really seriously. I know, it's hard for you to grasp that. But in the Jain tradition, there was actually a schism over the direction dress and the white dress people. So, but again, they're nice people and they generally tend to be rich. And interestingly, they tend to be rich for the same reason that you find in the Western world, traditionally a wealthy Jewish community. And that, not because the Jewish people went naked, but because the Jains, with all these severe rules about not disturbing the environment, they couldn't farm. Because when you farm, it's just like, you know, it's just like a massacre of bugs and worms, and it's just, you know, it's, when you just pull a plow through a field, all kinds of stuff happens. And they couldn't do that. And they lived in an agrarian society where the basis of wealth was land. So therefore they went into other things like, you know, trade. Because Krishna does say that the Vaishyas do, they do either agriculture, cow protection, which they didn't want to do also because it involves all kinds of stuff where you got to like kill bugs around the cows and everything. And so they didn't want to do farming, didn't do cow protection. So what's left? Vanija, trade. So they did trade and they became really good at it. And so the same thing, that's India which was more civilized. If you look at Europe historically, because of violent, murderous anti-Semitism, Jews were not allowed to own land. They couldn't do farming. They couldn't go into many professions. So therefore, and there was something in the Bible about you can't charge interest. You know, if you loan money, you can't charge interest. It's called usury. And so who wants to loan money if you can't make a buck on it? And so, but the Jews didn't have that rule, so they became moneylenders because legally they couldn't do anything else. They actually couldn't, they were not allowed to do anything else. Then they got, of course, insulted for doing the only thing they were legally allowed to do. So, you gotta love humans, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, so those are the Jains. Yes.
Maharaj, can you say that Krishna is giving all the time and also forgiving?
That's clever. Yes, giving and forgiving, but sometimes forgiving comes with a whack. I mean, you know, there is karma. And if you read the news, you can see that some people are really, you know, they're getting very heavy reactions because of what they did. And Krishna also takes from us, not because he needs it, but because parents need to teach their children not to be selfish. For example, when I was a little child, I had very good parents, and, you know, you've all done this. A mother's birthday, your father takes you to get a gift, right? And your father's birthday, your mother takes you, why? I mean, they didn't need it. I think for like 7 years in a row, we went to Save-On drugstore, and I bought my mother a little thing of, you know, multicolored bath soap, a little gel. I got it every year because that was like my mother's gift. So it's not that they needed it, but it's the duty of parents to teach their children to reciprocate, not to be selfish, not to be narcissistic. That's the duty of parents. Because if you don't teach your children, if you spoil your children, then you ruin your children. And so Krishna is not going to ruin us, and therefore he says, offer back. Offer back so that you become a civilized human being and hopefully a devotee. So, any other question? If not, I can tell. I mean, I can just, as an advanced Vaishnav, I can tell when the Vaishnavas are hungry. Yes, last question.
You make the comment about the king who was using Brahmanas to carry his palanquin.
Yes.
Then you went into the next column saying the hell that he went to, or the horrible reaction. Who was the king?
I think it was Nahusha.
And what was the reaction?
I forgot exactly, but he took birth in a very low birth. You can look it up in the database.
Snake.
What's that?
Snake.
Okay, yeah, that's right. He became a snake.
Python.
Python? Would you rather be a python? No. So, yeah, so I think that's it. You can look it up. But that's correct. You know, snake or python. So, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. And thanks to everyone who's watching on Facebook.